Prima de Vanguardem Class 11, 12, 3, Christmas 2014, New Vrindavan.
Sadhus offer the ultimate charity to mankind, serving as the guiding stars to shed light on the path and goal of human endeavor, without which our lives would be exceedingly dark and dreary and aimless and futile. Here the Lord is mentioning devotees of bygone ages, some Nityasiddhas, some sadhakas, and some even demons, who all attained at least salvation, if not pure devotional service, by association of devotees. Puranas are histories. Srimad Bhagavatam is Bhagavat Purana. Histories of bygone ages and the accounts of the various avatars and the avatari, Lord Sri Krishna, who have descended and who will descend in the future. The Bhavishya Purana offers a concise account of Shantavish avatars who would descend in future millenniums to award mankind at least that goal of salvation, if not the supreme goal of pure devotional service. In that Bhavishya Purana, the appearance of Muhammad and Jesus of Nazareth are described with sufficient detail that there can be no mistaking their authenticity and purpose. This is Srila Vyasadeva himself, 5,000 years ago, giving detailed accounts of the devotional history which would unfold in the upcoming Kali Yuga. And Srila Prabhupada himself speaks of Jesus with utmost reverence as our guru. And it's very wonderful to see how Srila Prabhupada, in his interactions with ministers and priests, he would be very heavy with them and almost usually immediately challenge them that the Ten Commandments says, "Thou shalt not kill." How can you claim to be men of God if you're eating meat? And they would all try to squirm out various ways, and he was relentless, because he was treating them almost like God brothers. And one time, when Srila Prabhupada was requested to meet one lord, which doesn't mean lord, really means nobleman of England, and Srila Prabhupada began this usual approach, accepting him as a Christian. "How can you claim to be a Christian if you eat meat?" And the nobleman said, "I've never eaten meat." To which Srila Prabhupada was so surprised. "How is that?" He said, "I grew up in Calcutta. influence of Vedic tradition, I would never remade. Srila Prabhupada became very curious, and an affinity was evolving between them, and Srila Prabhupada asked him, "When were you born?" And an old woman said, 1896 in Calcutta. And Srila Prabhupada was intrigued. "Do you know this place and that?" He said, "Yes, I know. These are the places of my childhood activities." So, today is the day assigned as the appearance of Jesus, although everybody knows that Jesus was actually born in the spring. But the early Christians, in an attempt to make conversion less of a shock to the pagans, used their day, the worship of the unconquered sun, as a day to worship the appearance of Jesus. Srila Vyasadeva, in his description of the event, offers a piece in that grand puzzle of Krishna's overall plan to spread light in this world of darkness. An analogy to help us understand the importance of bathing in the effulgence of great souls in scripture as a crucial component of our daily practice can be demonstrated by such an analogy as a man was traveling and he saw in a field a multitude of mules, which is unusual because usually in an agricultural field you see one or two or three teams of mules. This field was full of mules. So he stopped and asked the herdsman, "What are they all congregated here for?" He said, "These mules spend their lives underground. They work in the mines, pulling out the wagons full of coal. If we don't bring them out into the light once or twice a day, they'll go completely blind." So an ass is an analogy to a person who does not have much spiritual inclination. But even so, to come into the light as a daily practice of sadhana protects us from complete blindness and falling into the depths of ignorance to meet an unfortunate death that will take us who knows where. Srila Vyasadeva, in his Bhavishya Purana, tells us a brief account of a great king of the Aryans, although he doesn't mention his name, who defeated so many formidable adversaries in India and surrounding regions, including the Romans, who had extended their influence and conquest that far. And he succeeded in establishing clear boundaries separating the barbarians from the Aryans. And retiring from his activities as a Kshatriya king, he retired to the Himalayas, and in the region west of Tibet, saw in the mountains a saintly looking personality with a golden effulgence and white robes. And he was intrigued. And the king asked, "Who are you, sir?" To which that saintly person responded, "I am known as Ishaputra, the son of God, who was born of a virgin and sent as a prophet to the Lechas." And the king was intrigued. Asked him, "What will you teach? What principles of religion?" To which the sadhu, who is Jesus, responded, "As seeing the influence of barbarians spreading under the fostering care of Kali, I promote the path of purification with emphasis on truthfulness, peacefulness, and japa. And if we study the various religious movements of the world, we can see how the different religions over which people fight so much are different in their emphasis on different rasas. And even, say, Christians and Hindus may debate that it kind of looks like Christians just fabricated the story of Jesus after the birth of Lord Krishna, because there's so many similarities. A prophecy which the king hears about a humble soul born in most modest circumstances, who conquers over many challenges and rises to become the undisputed king of the land. And the reigning king, out of fear that his position will be usurped, inaugurates the slaughter of the infants, killing all male children born within the period the prophecy describes. And the Hindus suspect that the Christians took their story, and the Hindus suspect conversely. But what we should consider is that when the Lord descends or sends his representatives, there are many similarities in the way they appear and rise to the occasion. And if you study comparative religion, you can see that the religions of the West are reflections of the evolution of rasa in the collective consciousness of mankind in Bharatvarsha. Shanta rasa, which is neutrality, passive adoration of the Lord, dawned first in the East. And souls such as the four Kumaras, finding no satisfaction in sacrifice of material goods, found fulfillment in the super soul, that consciousness, like the rising of the sun in the east, gradually spreading to the west, illumined the great personality in Judea. Abraham, patriarch of the three faiths of Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, being the father of both Israel and Ishmael. Later, Dasyaras, like the sun again rising, revealing more about our relationship with God, rose in the east, perfected in Hanuman, and spreading west, that influence was revealed in the mood of Moses. Later, Arjuna in the east attained the privilege of friendship with the Lord, which, spreading like the rays of the sun, later touched the heart of one prophet in Arabia named Muhammad. And Vatsalya, perfected in Nanda Maharaja Braj, who loved God as his son, reflected and spread gradually to the west in the mood and mission of Jesus, who proclaimed love of God as Father. Whether we love God as Father or son. It's Vatsalya nevertheless, but Vaishnavas prefer to follow in the footsteps of Nanda Maharaj, in whose courtyard the Absolute Truth plays like a little child, because a child is always demanding of the father, and the Vaishnava as servant prefers to be supplying the demands of the Lord rather than making demands of him as we would to God the Father. In Madhurya Ras, which illumined all of Braj with a radiance of gold due to the influence of Srimati Radharani, whose mood Lord Chaitanya himself embraced and inaugurated the mission to spread that to the world in the chanting of the holy name, inaugurated a spiritual renaissance in Bharatvarsha, parallel to the mundane renaissance transpiring in Europe, during which time Columbus came sailing looking for a sea route to India, right at the time that Lord Chaitanya, as Nimai, was playing in Adya. But this mood of Madhurya, which includes and excels all other rasas, did not reach the shores of the Western world until 1965, when aboard a small, dark, weather-beaten cargo ship, the ambassador of Goloka reached the shores of Boston Harbor to ignite the Hare Krishna explosion. And even during the time of Srila Prabhupada's childhood, one great English pundit proclaimed that because he had some exposure to Gaudiya Vaishnava theology, and he proclaimed that the movements of the Golden Avatar have remained local for some time, but the time is approaching when they will resound and expand through the world with powers that will sleep no more. And while the Western people were approaching the satiation point in their worship of God as Father, a hankering was developing that there must be more to love of God than the distance of reverence mandated by rules and regulations, which fails to really touch the heart of the jiva or God himself, who long for intimacy in their loving exchanges. So, if you examine, Srila Prabhupada taught the science of Ras as summarized in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, in which Shantaras is described as realization of the continued existence of the individual soul within larger Brahman, which has an appearance of bliss, which is not really positive at all. It's simply the relief found in the cessation of extreme material miseries. And is deficient in the sense that in Shantaras there is no reciprocal relationship, which begins in Dasyaras, which marks the awakening of a service relationship, and the positive factor of affection arises in that exchange of service toward a most loving master. In Shantaras, the deficiency is that however great a personality, including God, may be, until we have some definite relationship with him, he's really of no special concern to us. That relationship, that concern, evolves in Dasyavas. He is my master. I am his loving servant. Dasyaras also has a distancing of love mandated by the master-servant relationship, a distance which is overcome when the jewel of confidentiality rises as the superior servant who is friend to his master. And Vatsalya is superior to Dasya in that of all friends, the best, most loved is one's own son, in which the constituent ingredients of all previous rasas are combined and excelled. But as each is superior to the previous, Madhurya is supreme amongst all. Because there's many things that are not shared, even in a relationship between parent and child. But there are no such secrets between lovers. And that would have to be the fullest achievement in a relationship with God. And Lord Chaitanya has come to this world to teach and demonstrate that rasa. In Brajadam, where all rasas are at least tinged with the sweetness of Madhurya, where Srimati Radharani is the original guru and whose sweetness pervades all aspects and devotees of Vrindavan, and where Krishna, even in his friendship with the Sakas, which is expressed in such play as wrestling, Krishna does not find the deepest fulfillment even with his intimate friends and parents. And Srimati Radharani, the Prem Guru, serves Krishna in every way, as the perfect servant, with the familiarity of a friend, the protection of a guardian, and the intimacy of a lover, which is the relationship Krishna relishes the most. So even when he's wrestling with his friends, he's not so deeply fulfilled, because there is no amorous dimension amongst friends. Srila Raghunath Das Goswami has spoken at length about the depths of Krishna's pastimes of wrestling. He explains that in the forest where the cows got lost, and the gopas very expertly were tracing out their footsteps. And when they found the lost cows in the distance, Krishna ascended a knoll and began waving his chatur and calling to them by name. And the cows came running and circled Krishna and licked them, and he embraced them, and the gopas chanted mantras to pacify them after being lost. And everyone was so happy when an agent of Kamsa, to retaliate the death of his friends, ignited a circle of fire which quickly rose to the sky like an inferno. And the gopas and cows were being showered with embers and sparks. And they formed a circle around Krishna to protect him. And they realized that there's no way we can protect Krishna from this inferno that is closing in fast. So they called out to Krishna, "Please save us." Knowing that they couldn't save him, and that he would respond more to their appeal to protect them, they pleaded, "Krishna, save us from this inferno." And Krishna said, "Just close your eyes." And they looked at him like, "How is closing our eyes going to protect us?" He said, "Just have faith." And the gopas looked at each other, "What is he going to do?" And they concluded, "He's going to chant some mantras." And mantras aren't effective if others see and hear them. So we have to close our eyes, which they did. But Krishna was thinking, if the gopas saw him swallow that inferno, they would die. And even if they didn't, they would tell Mother Yashoda, and she would die. So he did not want them to see how he saved them. He swallowed the forest fire and said, "Now open your eyes." And they found that not only was there no trace that a fire had ever existed, they were in a completely different forest than they were when the fire surrounded them. And they concluded that Krishna must be a demigod. And if we wrestle with Krishna, and we're equals with Krishna, we must be demigods too. And that made them very happy. And clapping and singing and playing their flutes and blowing their buffalo horns, they returned home to Braja and told their parents in an endless sankirtan about the wonders of Krishna that day. Raghunath Das Goswami, reflecting on the pastimes in that forest, tells that one time Krishna was not so deeply satisfied in the association of the gopas, so he wandered off alone and revealed his heart to one tree who he embraced. And the tree formed its roots into a kind of throne upon which Krishna sat and played upon his flute, which called out the name of Radha, who appeared there with her friends. And Krishna had his eyes closed, but he could sense her presence, and he opened his eyes. And he greeted the gopis. And they looked around because they were not familiar with this grove in the forest. And they saw that from the trees were hanging vines and swings. And there were branches tied between trees, like the types that athletes would use to do chin-ups. And there was a vine, like a swing, way over Jamuna where the gopis would swing out, plumbed into the water, and up above there is a tree house in the treetops. And in the middle was a rectangular area which was very clean, as if it was used for some kind of athletic event. And in the four corners were piles of stones with lines between them made of crystals. And Radha asked Krishna, "What kind of sport transpires here?" And he said, "This is where we wrestle." She became intrigued, said, "How do you dress dress as wrestlers. And Lalita asked, can we see you dressed as a wrestler? He said, no, we don't dress that way for fashion or show. When we dress as wrestlers, we go into hand-to-hand combat. And Lalita challenged Krishna that, why don't you wrestle with my heroine, Radha? And Krishna said, no, I'm royalty. I'm, you know, Kshatriya. I'm born in Mathura. How can I wrestle this frail cowherd girl? And Lalita said, if you're actually a Kshatriya, then how can you turn down a challenge? Either to fight or to protect the dignity of a lady. If your father hears that you decline the challenge, he will hang his head in shame, and you cannot tolerate that. And Krishna had to admit, you're right. And he was very happy that his pastime potency was unfolding just specifically according to his desire. So he said, well, we'll have to dress accordingly. So Krishna had a storehouse there. Well, Vrinda had a storehouse there, supplied with all the attire that the gopis would use for wrestling. So Krishna took an orange sash and he tied it tight like a belt and pulled up his dhoti kind of short to his knees and took off all his jewelry except his wristbands, so he looked like a wrestler. And the gopis ushered Radha into a cove and unbraided her hair and tied it up into a top knot and rearranged her sari the way that Kshatriya Matajis wear their, you know, like almost like a dhoti, kind of short. And then they crisscrossed her veil across her chest and back to hide her colorful choli so that she would be more convincingly in the attire of a wrestler. And then they all came face to face in the wrestling arena. And Krishna said, well, I can't really wrestle with, so I'll challenge you all simultaneously. He said, there's different sampradayas of wrestlers. We follow the sampradaya of Hanuman, and we are victorious even in battles with such demons as Ravana. And Vishakha said to her friend, he's comparing us to Ravana? And then, but there's other types of wrestling which can be more for pastime, so we'll engage in that type today. So, the gopis lined up, and Krishna challenged them all simultaneously. And he let out the roar of his battle cry, Jai Hanuman, he bellowed. And the gopis saw that this is serious. This is chivalrous. And simultaneously, he caught all the gopis behind and locked their arms behind their backs and pinned them down to the ground. But very gracefully, as if dancing, they extricated themselves from his grip. And all together, they pinned him down on the ground. And he was overcome by their superior might. But then he just disappeared. And he reappeared behind each and every one of the gopis and caught them again in that, what do you call it, arm lock or something? And he said, Krishna, that's not fair. That's foul play. You can't just disappear and then catch us from behind. So they ganged up on him and they pinned him down. And by close contact with each other, Radha was gaining strength and Krishna was losing it. And at this point, the gopis formed themselves in a circle. And Krishna would alternate between wrestling with each gopi in the circle and wrestling alone with Radha in the middle. And around the circle of gopis, all the birds and deer and creatures of the forest had gathered And they were so mesmerized by the event that they couldn't take sides until they saw that Krishna is losing and Radha is emerging victorious. And they all began to chant in this Nam Sankirtan, which spread throughout the world eventually. Jai Radhe! All glories to the goddess of victory. And she held Krishna down, pinned to the ground, until he pleaded in a groaning voice, "I surrender. I'm defeated." To which all the cowherd girls and birds and forests of the creatures of the forest just began clapping and cheering in great ecstasy. Krishna concludes his song on the battlefield, Bhagavad Gita, with the verse, "Manmana bhavama bhakto madhyadinam namaskara mamivashyasi satyam te prachijanam priyosime." It's all, the first two lines of the verse are identical with the verse at the end of the ninth chapter, in which Krishna is proclaiming the love of his devotees for him. And here at the close of the 18th chapter, he is proclaiming the reciprocal sentiment of his love for his devotees. And out of love, Krishna makes his solemn promise that if you always think of me, always remember me, become my devotee, bow down and offer your homage unto me, then he will come to me. He will come home without fail. I promise you this because, priyosime, you are my very dear friend. Krishna had to give his promise because some people think he was born in Mathura. And Mathura is a place of Kshatriyas who tend to be chivalrous and diplomatic. Which means the simple gopas can't necessarily take at face value whatever they may say. So Krishna says, "I promise, by remembrance of me, you will come home to me," because speaking to the world through Arjuna, "You're all my very dear friends." Jesus said, as the conclusion of his teachings, that "I have so much more to tell you, but you cannot bear to hear it now." If we examine all the theistic developments in the world since time immemorial, they're like pieces of a grand puzzle. The overall picture, which is displayed when that great Shaktavish avatar, Nityananda Vesh, Srila Prabhupada, appeared on western shores and ignited the Hare Krishna explosion. In that wrestling arena where Radha emerged victorious over Krishna, there was only one person who hadn't taken sides. And you know, the way they were all clapping their palms on the ground and cheering, there was one person who was, only one person who was neutral. That was Cupid himself. Arjuna asked Krishna, "What is it that inspires man to act in sinful ways, even contrary to his desire?" And Krishna said, "It's lust and lust only, O Arjuna, all-devouring sinful enemy of the world. How can that root cause of sinful activity be conquered?" Maya Devi herself approached Haridas Thakur in the dead of night on that very enchanting moonlit shore of the Ganges and proposed with feminine gestures that would bewilder the mind of even Brahma, he was not moved in the least, because he was absorbed in the Maha Mantra, composed of the names of Radha and Krishna, in which their amorous pastimes are fully contained, and by which, absorbing our hearts in the song of the Maha Mantra, Kibbu, who incites lusty desires and sinful activities, becomes conquered and subdued, and our hearts can be given completely to Krishna in the love of devotional service, which is the perfection and goal of human life. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments?
Can you talk more about the similarities that you addressed between the birth of Christ and the birth of Krishna?
There was an evil king in Mathura, Wisconsin, in Judea, with Herod. And both evil kings heard this prophecy about a child who would be born in humble circumstances, overcome challenges, and rise to become the undisputed king of the land. Krishna was born in a dungeon, although his name-giving ceremony, which is kind of a birth celebration, was performed in the cowshed. Jesus was born in a cowshed. You know, you see in the nativity scene camels and other things, but it was really a cave, but for cows. And camels and donkeys, many things that came along. Krishna defeated all the Rakshasa monsters sent by Kamsa. Oh, and the slaughter of the infants issued by Kamsa. Kill all children born in the period that it appears that Krishna was born. And Herod sent his forces to the city of David to annihilate all children born about the time that the three wise men, the Magi from Persia, had come to worship the prophesied Messiah. Slaughter of the infants. And then comes the challenges. For Krishna, it was the Rakshasas sent by Kamsa, and then Kamsa himself with the real wrestlers, Chandra and Mushtika, which was a fight to the death, in which Krishna was the victor. And for Jesus, it was the full might of the combined influence of the Pharisees and the Romans in a conspiracy to put him to death in the most disgraceful manner. But he emerged victorious even over death in the resurrection, which actually defeated the Romans in the full might of their empire. So, to further the humiliation the Romans put over Jesus as they were crucifying him, King of the Jews, but it actually turned out to be the reality. In his glory they were proclaiming in jest and mockery. Whereas for Krishna, after Kamsa, Kamsa, he went on to defeat Charisanda and Kalyavana and all the great demoniac empires of the world. And in the end, they each took their followers back home with them. And individually, the similarity is what's transpiring in our own hearts. In the birth of our infant Krishna consciousness transpires, then there are all the challenges of the demons within, all the lust and anger and greed and pride, illusion and envy. They see that they're being challenged as they never were before. And they rise to overpower us, to discourage us in pursuing this relationship with Krishna. And there's no way we can succeed on our own but to take exclusive shelter of the holy name of Krishna, the association of devotees, the instructions of Guru Sahib and Shastra, and then our own infinite Krishna consciousness will emerge victorious over all the enemies of the world, within and without. We too will go home in due course of time. Yes.
One of the big criticisms of the modern celebration of Christmas is the commercialization of the original offering of gifts by the wise men to the newborn child. There is a recommendation by our acharyas that to involve yourself in a loving relationship, there are activities. One of them is to receive, one of them is to give gifts. So, how are we to see this gift-giving phenomenon that has kind of evolved to this frenzy of Christmas shopping and the day of Christmas? And how does that relate to our Vaishnav understanding of offering gifts to God and his devotees as a way of showing love?
That is a wonderful and appropriate question. Thank you. First of all, where does this imagery come from of a tree that never fades, that is luminous with light, and around which whatever you desire just miraculously appears? There is a land made of transcendental touchstone with forests of kalpavrikshas and kamadhenus that fulfill all desires. And very prominent in the Christmas season, which is actually wonderful because, you know, holiday originally meant holy day, and the spirit of St. Nicholas really prevails the holiday season. And in that mood, remembrance of St. Nicholas, people become good-natured, charitable, kind, and the faults that, you know, preoccupy our vision most of the year are adjusted to see the beauty in life and one another. This is the mere remembrance of, and who is St. Nicholas, whose secular substitute is Santa Claus? St. Nicholas was a devout follower of the teachings of Jesus, who lost his parents as a child and invested all his inheritance in charity. And as a child, he was elevated to the role of bishop in this shore. He was on the shore of Turkey, which made him inspired him to become the patron saint of both sailors and children. And in distributing his inheritance as charity to the poor and needy, there was a man in that town who was very poor. And he had two daughters. But in that culture, a man could not find a good husband for his daughters without offering a suitable dowry, which the man couldn't do. And furthermore, he was in debt to begin with. His daughters were scheduled to be sold into slavery to pay the man's debt, and because they could never find good husbands, they would have no alternative to slavery. And these children were so devoted to their father that they washed their finest clothes and hung them to dry by the fire so that they could bring the highest price in the auction. And while their stockings were drying on the mantle of the window next to the fireplace, along comes St. Nicholas and drops bags of gold into the stockings, which both protected them from slavery and offered the dowry by which their father could be freed from the debt and they could achieve good husbands. So, it was actually St. Nicholas whose feast day is in December, the patron saint of children and sailors, whose spirit is prominent in the holiday season. And the activity of giving gifts is one of the loving exchanges amongst devotees. But with commercialization and secularization, the spirit of St. Nicholas is usurped by this fictitious character, Santa Claus, who is actually the embodiment of karmakanda. Because Santa Claus gives you good gifts if you're nice, and he puts coal in your stockings if you're bad. But karmakanda is a very inferior path to that of bhakti, the path of St. Nicholas, who paved the way for Srila Prabhupada to come and teach how to properly give gifts as one of the six loving exchanges between devotees, which gives satisfaction to the heart because it demonstrates the love of Krishna, which is too abstract for us, except for the relationships with these devotees, which gives an indication of the kindness and sweetness and wonder of their master, Sri Krishna. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
You can bring maybe your dirty clothes. I can close clothing.
That is below your dignity.
Come on, Amart, please. I'm going to give you some trash bags. I need to remember to give you some trash bags so you can have trash bags and get your laundry.